The next case on calendar this morning is Sahabi versus State. And I'm going to ask counsel to do the same thing that we did in the last proceeding, which is each of you give a brief summary to the students of what this case is about, and factually, and a bit about the law. You may go first.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Matt Lay. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Harrell Zahabi. My client is a gambler who gambled throughout the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s at Las Vegas area casinos. He started at first gambling using his own money, and as time went by, he began using something called casino credit. For those of you, everyone here who's under 21 has never gambled or been to a casino for gambling. A casino marker is something that the casinos give you. Before they do it, they run your credit, they check your bank balances, they look at your action or what sort of play you've been doing in other casinos throughout the state, throughout the United States, throughout the world, and then based on that information, they make a decision to issue credit. So in this case, my client, from the 1990s forward, has been gambling using casino credit. They give him chips, and he uses those at casino games. In this case, his preferred game was Baccarat. He's played roulette in the past. And typically, with these markers, you're given a certain amount of time to pay. My client has always had the ability to pay these markers. And in this case, he took out markers in approximately $700,000 and was unable to pay the markers in the time requested by the casinos. And so in Nevada, we have what's called the bad check statute. And under that statute, the state of Nevada can prosecute someone who takes out casino markers and doesn't pay them back per the terms of the agreement. And so in this case, my client was sued civilly for some of the markers, which is something that the casinos can do. And then he was also charged criminally by the other casinos, or by the state, through the bad check statute. And that's how we're here today. He went to trial. He was convicted of the four counts. And he subsequently appealed his conviction and went before the Nevada Supreme Court. I was not the attorney that handled the trial, and I was appointed, sent back by this court to the district court where the trials happen, and I was appointed by the district court to represent Mr. Zahabi. So after some briefing, that's how we got here. And some of the issues in the brief that you're going to see this morning are, first, whether our bad check statutes is... whether there were some jury instructions, and jury instructions are a means by which the judge instructs the jury on the law of the case. The defense, which represented Mr. Zahabi, proposed some jury instructions. The state chose not to give the judge chose not to give those. And the basic jury instruction was that the casinos, having knowledge that he was unable to pay, should have negated his intent to defraud the casinos, or at the very least, been something that the jury considered. Also, there's a question in Nevada law that we've raised of whether or not the fact that the casinos deposited the checks later than the day that they were issued, turned them into post-dated checks, and sort of made them like a short-term or payday-type loan. And then finally, we argue that the statute under which he was convicted, the bad check statute, is unconstitutional, because in Nevada we have a constitutional provision that says you can't convict someone for a debt, imprison them for a debt, without the showing of fraud. And it's our argument that the statute as it's written only requires the intent of the fraud, which is one of five elements of fraud. So that's kind of a capsule of our case. Thank you for allowing us to come today, and I hope we give you a good show.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zembrowski, do you want to give a brief overview of the case from your perspective?
Thank you. My name is Bernard Zembrowski. I'm a chief deputy district attorney at the Clark County District Attorney's Office in Las Vegas. And I actually prosecuted this case 2 years ago. I agree with everything you said about what this case is about. We just disagree on whether things were appropriately done or not. Let me give you just a very, very brief, this is a very unique area of the law. It's unique in that Nevada was and continues to be really the only state in the country that allows for prosecution of markers that are drawn on a line of credit issued by a licensed gaming establishment. And what that is the difference between other states and Nevada is that other states treat them specifically as civil credit issues. Although, with the proliferation of Indian gaming across the country, other states are looking at Nevada, which is really the leader when it comes to gaming markers and law with regard to gaming institutions. Other states are looking at Nevada's laws to support their own cases. But in essence, Nevada treats markers drawn on the line of credit as criminal matters in addition to civil matters. The best way I can describe this for you is it's really quite simple when you think about it. If you go into a grocery store and you want to purchase eggs and milk, and you walk up to the checker and say, here's my money for the eggs and milk. You get your eggs and milk, the grocery store gets their money right then and there. That is a current exchange of value. You give something of value in exchange for something of value. All right? That's the typical type of situation you have. If somebody writes a check, if that check bounces for those eggs and milk, well, you can be prosecuted if you have the intent to defraud. However, if you were to take that same situation, and if you were to, when you came to the counter or the checker and said, put that on my account, all right, put that on my account, that's a credit situation. You're in essence getting something now in exchange for payment in the future. That is not the kind of case that is covered under the bad check statute, because that is a credit situation. It's not an exchange of value currently. I hope I stated that correctly. It may be a little too simple, but I think it works. So I agree with everything he says factually that happened, but we have a disagreement on what the law in Nevada is. The state's position is that the jury instruction, which instructs the jury when they go back to deliberate what they can consider legally when they apply the facts or the law to the facts, we disagree as to whether or not the jury instruction was appropriate. We also disagree on the constitutionality of the statute itself. And thank you for allowing me this time to explain this.
Thank you very much. Mr. May. Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. May I reserve 3 minutes?
Of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Matthew Lay, and I represent the appellant, Harel Zahavi. This matter is on appeal from a judgment of conviction entered in the 8th Judicial District Court. In this case, the testimony at trial revealed that as early as 1999, Mr. Zahavi gambled and lost hundreds of thousands of dollars at Las Vegas area casinos using casino credit, including the casinos involved in this case. During his 10-year history of gambling that was documented at trial, Mr. Zahavi routinely paid his markers slowly, but the casinos never deposited any of those markers for payment. In the instant matter, from October through December of 2008, Mr. Zahavi gambled and lost approximately $700,000 in casino markers that were loaned to him by various Las Vegas casinos. This time, however, due to declines in his business, in the general downturn in the economy, Mr. Zahavi was not able to repay the debts to the casinos before they deposited the markers for payment. Therefore, in this case, he was convicted of 4 separate counts of violating Nevada's bad check statute. That's NRS 205.130. This morning, I'd like to focus my argument on 3 areas. First, this court should reverse Mr. Zahavi's judgment of conviction, because the district court failed to instruct the jury that the casino's knowledge of Mr. Zahavi's inability to pay those casino markers negated his intent to defraud, or, alternatively, constituted an affirmative defense. Second, this court should reverse Mr. Zahavi's conviction because the district court improperly instructed the jury that the casino's decision to hold the markers did not convert them from a marker to a loan, when in fact that is exactly what they did. And finally, this court should reverse Mr. Zahavi's conviction because Nevada's bad check statute is facially unconstitutional.
Mr. Ray, I guess one question I had, and the students might have, is why did your client accept the money from the casino, the extra money referenced by the marker, which became a check and no one was deposited, if he didn't have the ability to pay it back because of his business reverses and all? He could have said, no, I don't want it, I can't pay it back, and I don't have the money here to gamble, like probably many people do, don't gamble because they don't have the money to do it. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, my client early on gambled small amounts, and so typically he was able to pay. But as time went by, he was given larger and larger increases in credit. He used that line of credit throughout the 90s, throughout the 2000s. He went ahead and gambled with those. He was slow to pay, and this is something that we heard testimony about from a variety of the casinos, especially the Venetian. He had a 10-year history. They knew that he was slow to pay. Every time he would end up paying off the markers, they would go ahead and increase his credit limit, either by his request or at their own request. What happened was with his situation is that he always believed that he had the ability to pay. The casinos were typically very flexible with negotiating the payment date, that term of the contract between the casinos and Mr. Zahavi. So it was never an issue. I mean, there were occasionally threats where they'd say, hey, look, we're going to deposit this marker if you don't pay. But there was never a situation in which the marker was actually deposited, and he was always able to pay those markers. So on one hand, he always held out the hope, and he testified to this at trial, that he would be able to pay the markers somehow. Now, as time went by, it became increasingly difficult, and there's some evidence and there was some testimony at trial about, you know, to what extent he was a problem gambler. But, you know, throughout time, up until this time, he was able to find a way to pay those markers. And so for him, even though, you know, he was a slow payer and those sorts of things, he was always able to make those payments. So that never was, you know, truly an issue that discouraged him from gaming. Okay, now trial, there was a supplemental jury instruction that the defense proposed. In that supplemental jury instruction, the language provided the following. It is a defense that the defendant proves by a preponderance of the evidence that at the time the check was issued, the casino knew, had been expressly notified, or had reason to believe that the defendant did not have sufficient funds on deposit with the bank to ensure the payment on presentation of such a marker. So the reason that the defense proposed this instruction is that there are several cases, starting with the Poyet case in California and going through to the Orth case in West Virginia. It covers all of the sort of contingencies covered in that supplemental and jury instruction. So, for example, in Poyet, the court held that the affirmative disclosure, essentially, of a present insufficiency of funds is a defense to statutes where the intent of a fraud is an element. And so, I'm sorry, Judge Sherry, do you have a question?
I was going to say, why did the court reject that instruction? It sounds pretty good to me that it's your defense. And aren't you entitled to a jury instruction that states your defense?
That's true. One of the issues involved in this case is that Mr. Zahavi was presented from providing the jury with an instruction on his theory of the case. Now, the state argued that there wasn't sufficient evidence, but, you know, as I will hope to demonstrate, there's a long history of evidence to support that.
The judge, in fact, agreed with that position, and looking through the transcript, she actually indicated when we were settling that instruction that she thought it negated the fourth element of the offense, but yet she wouldn't instruct. Did you carry on when she stated that? What kind of follow-up did you make? Or I guess it wasn't you at the
end. It wasn't me, but there was extensive argument about that element, and there was some, you know, basically the end result of that colloquy between the court and the attorneys at that time was that I'm not giving that instruction. Even though there was that long discussion about how, you know, A, it should negate his intent to defraud, or B, it should go to the jury. But at the end of the day, the court's rationale or reasoning was, I'm not going to give that instruction. So there wasn't really a well-developed explanation or rationale for that particular.
But she essentially agreed with the position.
That's correct. But she did something different than what she
did. Trial counsel argue that theory?
That's correct. There were approximately 50 pages of jury instruction, and probably half of those was devoted to this very issue. Okay, so in Hubbard, which is a Virginia case,
misunderstood me. In final argument, did trial counsel argue this? In final argument.
And here's the situation. The judge said that the counsel at the time was free to argue, you know, that this, you know, sort of undermined the intent of the fraud, but she wouldn't instruct the jury affirmatively, and that's where the issue arose. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Okay. Now, in the Hubbard case, it's a Virginia case, and the court in that case said that knowledge or an understanding, so they're moving now beyond just an affirmative disclosure, they're going to knowledge and understanding. Also, in the Griffith case, they used the language, good reason to believe that the check will be paid. And finally, in Zent, there's a reasonable expectation that the check will be paid. So there's sort of a softening from this line of affirmative defense down through knowledge on the part of the payee or the reason to believe that the check will be paid. And then we wind up in West Virginia. It's a case where a person was a problem gambler at a casino track and was cashing checks. The casino knew that the person was unable to pay for these checks because they were receiving these checks as unpaid back, allowed the person to continue to cash checks at the racetrack because they wanted the person to keep gaming.
And Mr. Ryan, do you agree that the time when one looks at the intent to defraud is when the marker is signed?
I would agree that I would agree that it's at the time the marker is signed.
What evidence was there in the record to support the claim or the defense that there was insufficient knowledge of insufficient funds at the time the marker was signed in each of the four markers?
Okay. For example, in the Hard Rock case, the Hard Rock issued Mr. Zahavi $100,000 in markers. They did this knowing that he owed 400,000 markers around town. The person that testified on behalf of the Hard Rock indicated that when they issued these markers to Mr. Zahavi, it was on a Friday. They called over to the Wynn. The Wynn had some of his banking information. They found out that between two counts that he only had $27,000 in the bank. Additionally, they found out that when the Wynn inquired about his bank accounts, that was 2 months before. So 2 months had elapsed since they last checked his bank accounts. So they went ahead and issued the markers for $100,000 anyway. And then at the conclusion of the testimony, he said that they checked the bank account 2 days later after they had given him the markers. Now, in the case of the Venetian, they had indicated that he was a slow payer throughout his tenure history. There were two occasions where he was a slow payer. Mr. Zahavi testified that he had given his casino host, who was often his go-between negotiating for him on behalf of these extensions of time, that he was having trouble increasingly paying these markers. So there was testimony that he had owned some commercial property that he had to mortgage in order to make this. There was a stock account that he had to liquidate in order to make his last payment. So the casinos had knowledge of that sort of thing, and despite that, they agreed to give him a $250,000 line of credit when he had credit out all over town and that sort of thing. Now, in the case of Caesar's Palace, Mr. Zahavi testified that he had not been to Caesar's Palace for approximately 4 years. He went in, he told the casino host, who was apparently the representative for Middle Eastern gamblers, and told that person, hey, look, I'm in trouble. I've got markers of $600,000 out all over town, and I'm having trouble making these payments. Can I get a marker? She said some time went by, and they came back and gave him $100,000. So, and the one thing I'd like to note is, for all intents and purposes, the Venetian and the Palazzo are administered by the same collections department, so that would cover both of those markers. So in each case, there was some knowledge that the casinos had. Now, the other thing I would point out is that there was an issue where these casinos have all of this information available to them. For example, they can go, before you get any credit at these casinos, they make you sign basically a release where they can go in and look at your bank account. They can see your high and low history. They can see your daily balance. It's not down to the penny, but it's sort of an average balance on a daily basis. They can do this at every time. They can do it once a month. They can do it once a year. They can do it every day if they'd like to. A lot of these casinos said, hey, look, we didn't do it on this day because we knew of his player history. He was a good payer at these other casinos, you know, so on and so forth. Now, the other thing that they have available to them is something called Central Credit. Central Credit is a company that's set up just for casino gaming. And what happens is people from casinos from Nevada will report a player's history. They'll do high and low payments, how much he's gambled at a casino, what his daily wins are, any return items or return balance that he would have at any gaming company, and that includes the United States and throughout the world. So they had the ability to go in and see what his payment history was like, what sort of markers he had outstanding, and those sorts of information. And some of these casinos testified, like in the example of the Hard Rock, they didn't even do that. They just called the Wynn and said, hey, what do you know about this guy? So, I think there's a situation here where the casinos didn't do some due diligence in deciding to extend Mr. Zahavi credit and are now trying to hide behind the bad check statute as a way to make up for that error.
And your proposed instruction number 9 would have been that the casinos knew or had reason to know.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's
and
correct.
That's, you're drawing that reason to know standard from cases elsewhere.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the one other thing I'd like to point on is that Mr. Zahavi testified at trial, and one of the things that he testified about specifically is that he knew he had to pay these markers back. I see that my time is up and I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll go ahead and take my seat now.
Thank you. When you come back up, I would like to hear a bit about the constitutional issue as
sure,
well.
Sure, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The court. Can you hear me okay with this?
have some problems with this thing. At,
you shouldn't have touched it.
I touched it. I'll hold it. Please, Honorable Court, there are three issues here, and I think counsel has aptly pointed out the facts of the case. I have no disagreement with the factual statements that he's made with regard to the case.
Can I just cut to the chase real quick, Mr. Sadowski? Is it your position and the Clark County District Attorney's position that the legislation that's involved here, that if, even if the casino knows or should know that there's insufficient funds, that they can still be, that the defendant can still be prosecuted criminally?
Absolutely not. And that's, I'll make that my first point then, Justice Chair. What the state disagrees with here in these three issues, and I'll take the first one, and I think it's the one we spent the most time on. The law, or the proposed jury instruction, 9A, if I may read it very briefly. In connection with the element of intent to defraud, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt when the marker was issued, the casino had no knowledge or no reason to believe that the defendant had insufficient funds on deposit in his bank to pay the marker. Stated differently, the element of intent to defraud is negated if the casino knew or had reason to believe that the defendant did not have sufficient funds on deposit with the bank to ensure payment on presentation of such marker. That is a false statement of the law. It's a false statement of the law in Nevada. It's a false statement of the law in California, where the decision of Poyet came from. And here's why. If you read the Poyet decision, the court basically said, you have to tell us that you didn't have the sufficient funds in the account when you sign it. Poyet also required that the victim in the case, we'll call him the payee, that the payee understood that, accepted it, and went ahead and accepted the check anyway, agreeing to turn this into a revolving credit situation as opposed to a payable on demand note. So my position and the state's position when I tried this case 2 years ago was that this particular instruction, which is drawn from a California jury instruction, is only partially correct. It basically gives you the first part of the jury instruction, which is the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the casino had no knowledge. But it doesn't talk at all about the second part of that, which is that the casino then agreed at that point to take the check and consider this a line of credit. And that is the main problem with supplemental jury instruction number 9. As for the question of whether a person who says, hey, I don't have the money here, but here's a check, will you take it? I'll put it in tomorrow. And by the way, that's one of the cases that the appellant cites. It doesn't matter how much time passes. If you say, I don't have the money in the account right now, I will pay you tomorrow. I will get that money in the account by tomorrow. If you assent to that at that point as the payee, then you have, in essence, changed the nature of the instrument from a payable on demand note to a line of credit.
Mr. Zdrowski.
Yes.
Accepting your characterization of Poyet and the second element that you've referred to, why wouldn't the jury be able to infer from the facts, at least in the case of the Hard Rock credit or marker, that they had knowledge and issued the $100,000 marker with knowledge that there was only $27,000 in the bank just a couple of months before?
Justice Sardis, that is an excellent question. Here's the issue. NRS 205.130 states that a person must have sufficient money, property, or credit to be able to clear these checks, in essence, all right? So the casino, merely knowing that he had outstanding credit outside of the casino that he was there attempting to get markers from, isn't sufficient for the casino to be on notice that he doesn't have sufficient money, property, or credit. They can check average balances and current balances. That's not the full extent of what NRS 205.130 says. The casino And by the way, there was testimony about this from a representative of the Hard Rock. The casino knows and understands that it is common practice for sophisticated gamblers to hold accounts where they have lines of credit attached to them. I would note for the record, and it does not involve this case, but a case that this court has recently heard, a case involving, and this is standard practice in the industry, Justice Sata authored the opinion. In that particular case, the defendant in the criminal case had an operating account. He also then had, which is typical, a line of credit attached to that operating account, which is an investment account that contained literally millions of dollars that they would then transfer by electronic means, transfer money from this this particular type of investment account into an operating account. It's very common practice. It's also very common practice for people to have bank accounts that they do not give to the casino, where they will use the operating account from the casino and wire money and their funds in there. And their bank has an agreement with those other banking institutions to transfer money and property in and out of there. So it is not sufficient to say that simply because the casino at the time knew that he had $700,000 in outstanding markers, that they knew he did not have enough money or did not have a reason to believe that he didn't have money in the account.
Your argument seems to reject the notion, though, that has reason to know is also a reasonable part of that instruction.
Justice Augustine, I believe that that would cause a casino that deals with million-dollar gamblers on a regular basis would cause them no concern, perhaps some concern. Let me rephrase that. $700,000 in markers might cause them some concern, but a casino, when they're faced with the daily aspect of players wiring money in from other credit accounts, in addition to, and this is something that is extremely important, in addition to the affirmative representation by the player that they have the money in the account at the time that they write the check. I know one of your justices asked, is it important, actually you did, Justice Hardesty, is it important that the crime occurs, that the intent to defraud occurs at the time that they write the check? And that is absolutely true. It doesn't occur when the bank deposits the check at a later date. But that's important. If I may get back, I hope I answered that question. If I may get back to my original position, here's why it's improper in Nevada, an additional reason. It's not a correct statement of the law. Secondly, it confuses the jury. In Nevada, as I alluded to in my initial statement, we have a unique situation where under Wynn versus State, a case that was argued in this court approximately 10 years ago, the Nevada Supreme Court has said that merely agreeing to hold a marker for a period of time does not change the nature of the instrument from a payable on demand check to a line of credit. So to give this instruction would cause serious problems with the jury, because the jury would then be saying, well, they knew that they weren't collecting right away. They agreed to hold it for a specified period of time, so therefore they must have known. And that would cause a tremendous amount of problems with the jury and confusion with the jury, because under Nevada law, under Wynn versus State, the fact that the casino agrees to hold the marker does not evidence an agreement to turn the instrument from a line of from a payable on demand note into a line of credit. And I think that's probably the most important aspect of the argument that I made against including this particular jury instruction. Secondly, there was the other jury instruction number two, which stated,
let me pause you there just for a moment. On the you're pronouncing it Wynn case, are you over-reading it a bit when you say the fact that the casino held the marker and didn't deposit it immediately doesn't convert it into a loan? The court's opinion used the word the mere fact that the markers were held for a period of time does not transform that. But going to the Hard Rock issue combined with the holding of these, why is that not reason to know that he may have insufficient funds and therefore something that merited telling the jury about, so that if they bought that argument, they could have acquitted this gentleman?
Because he, may I answer? Because he,
you have 5 more minutes.
Oh, okay, that's what that means. Because he had stated, both in his credit application, which was taken out at some period of time before the actual marker was signed, that he had sufficient funds in the bank presently. Also, because he had stated on the marker itself, when he signed the marker, the language under the signature line states that he has sufficient funds in the bank now, presently. That's the evidence that was presented. The facts of Lynn are strikingly similar. I always wanted to say strikingly, and I guess in the Supreme Court that's a great place to say it. The facts are strikingly similar. And Lynn, we had a same position where it was the casino that took the marker. They agreed up front to hold it for a period of 30 days. They put no date and no time for the presentment of the check. The defendant in Wynn waived the issue of presentment of the check, meaning he agrees that the casino has the right to place the date and any bank imprint information on the check when they decide to cash it. Those are the exact same facts that have occurred in this particular case.
Mr. Zdrowski, I'm looking at the marker that was signed to the Hard Rock. It's record AA46. And from what I can see, I don't see a representation made by Mr. Zahavi that he has $100,000 in his bank. What I see is a representation made by him authorizing Hard Rock to conduct a credit check with a credit bureau or obtain information regarding my bank accounts. But he doesn't say I actually have $100,000 in my bank. And at the bottom, I'd like you to address that in light of what you had just represented. But at the bottom of that, he also says that this is payable 7 days after my departure from the casino. Does that affect the date on which one should examine the insufficient fund knowledge of the casino?
Justice Hornsby, I don't think it does, and I'll tell you why. I don't think it matters whether the check states this is payable 7 days later, or if it's 14 days later, as in the Ray Armstrong case that the defendant cited to, or if they agree to hold it for an additional 30 days. And I think Wynn, and I hope I'm not overreading Wynn, I think Wynn addresses that issue when they say it doesn't change the nature of the instrument from a payable on-demand note into a loan, or to a loan. Wynn seems to suggest there must be other evidence that the casino assented to that. In this particular case, there was testimony from the witnesses that they did not look at the granting of a unspecified period of time of which they would hold the markers. They did not agree that that changed the nature of the instrument. And I apologize, I unfortunately have that particular check on my computer. The checks have both the boilerplate language underneath the signature of the marker, as well as the line of the casino credit application, which indicates that these are checks subject to Nevada law. Furthermore, it is, I would say, common knowledge that a check, when a person gives a check presently for goods or services, whether that language is contained on there, whether there's an affirmative representation that they have the money in the account or not, a check means exactly that. It's not a promise to pay in the future. It is a statement by the maker of that check that they have the funds that to be able to pay that at that point.
Mrs. Zagowski, since these students someday may want to obtain credit when they reach 21 at a casino,
Also, I'd like you to tell them that that's a good question, Justice Cherry, just like you did with Justice Hardesty, okay? I guess I didn't get any reaction to that. Is there any obligation on behalf of the casino to the borrower as to when they know that there's a possibility that there's insufficient funds? Do they have any obligation to say, now look, we have to agree to this, and this is why we have to comply with the statute? Is there anything in the statute that puts any type of affirmative action on the casino itself to tell the degenerate gambler that they have to comply with certain things before he would not be liable criminally?
No, there isn't anything in the statute that places an affirmative duty on the casino to do that. There's no affirmative duty for the casino, likewise, to conduct a credit check. I will say, however, having been the chief deputy in the bad check unit for a total of 7 years, and then prosecuting this case afterwards and continuing to prosecute bad check cases, that the casinos have made great strides. I sat at the table with Bill Hain as a young prosecutor in 1999 when Wynn versus State, I put that preliminary hearing on with Mr. Hain. I did the deal. And I can say that since that time, great strides have been made by the casinos to educate gamblers and patrons of the problems of gambling and to not break the bank, if you will, when they're gambling. However, the statute itself places no affirmative duty on the casino to alert them. I know that casinos very frequently will walk players when they say, okay, we've had enough, you need to go take a break. I hope that answers your question.
Was it a good question?
Was it what?
Was it a good question?
It was a great question, Justice Cherry.
Thank you.
Chief, if I may, I know he's out of time, but could you very briefly address the constitutional issue in this case and your position why the statute isn't violative of the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 14 of the Nevada Constitution? Just briefly.
Thank you, Justice Perigary. The state's position is simple. This court should not read into a statute what is not there. The statute, we should presume that the legislature purposely and intended to leave out common law fraud from the proof requirement of this statute. The legislature, when they passed 205.130, used this specific language, intent to defraud, meaning the one element that the defense, that the appellant has alluded to. They did not state that common law fraud should be required to prove as an element of the offense. And so our position is that the court should not read into what the legislature desired to pass on behalf of the people, that common law fraud be required, only the intent to defraud. I would also note that there is no case cited by the defense, and he has the burden to show that it should be changed under a great presumption that it shouldn't. There is no case, either in Nevada or anywhere in the country, involving bad check statutes where the element of intent to defraud is required, where common law fraud is required.
Before you start, the Nevada constitutional provision is there shall be no imprisonment for debt except in cases of fraud. That's the constitutional provision. So the question, as I understand it, is whether or not this statute, which requires intent to defraud but not the other historical elements of fraud, passes constitutional muster. Is that your argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. And going back and reviewing the legislative history behind the Constitution, this is a provision from 1864, most likely imported from California. There's very little in the way of commentary or rationale behind why it was included. I mean, it's one page in the reporter from that period. Now, the argument is basic. It's that intent to defraud, as it's envisioned in the bad check statute, is merely one element of common law fraud. Now, we don't have a general fraud statute in Nevada that Mr. Zahavi could have been prosecuted under, and because that's not there, we're missing four elements of common law fraud. And just for the court's knowledge, the elements of common law fraud are misrepresentation by the defendant, knowledge of the misrepresentation, the intent to defraud, reliance by the plaintiff, and actual damage. And so I point to the state's own answering brief in this case, where they said that the bad check statute consists of the following three elements, and these are their words: intent to defraud, the making or passing of a check for the payment of money without sufficient funds. So we have the elements of the bad check statute. By the state's own words, three elements are required. Fraud requires five elements. So even under a generous reading of the statute, in the state's own words, we don't have the common law elements of fraud. And the one thing I'd like to point out, yes, there's no, you know, I freely admit there's been no case cited, but I mean, there aren't cases out there that exist. This is a novel area of law, and I don't think the fact that there, you know, is sparse or very few cases on the subject should foreclose novel arguments in the law, and I just don't think the court should take that into consideration. I mean, I think it's a legitimate argument that the court should consider.
Okay, switching subjects.
Sure.
How do you respond to Mr. Zdrowski's argument that the Wynn case is in all fours and it completely defeats your instruction, jury instruction number 9 that you wanted to have given?
Okay, well, in the Wynn case, the one key difference between Wynn and our case is that the Wynn court noted specifically that the dates of the markers were on the markers. So he took out the, you know, for example, I don't have the exact case in front of me, September 1st he took out the marker, and the markers were dated September 1st. If you review the markers in this case and review the testimony, the casinos testified that they didn't actually put the dates on until they were sent through for the deposit, in addition to other things like the routing number or Mr. Zahavi's account number that he had provided when he did the credit application. And so the dates are different from the time he actually gambled, number one. Also, this idea about how the marker language contains a 7-day, like in the case of, you know, I heard you discuss before, the Hard Rock, even if the language is on there, it says there's 7 days to pay, the casinos routinely disregarded that language. Every casino testified that there were various disposition dates, 30, 60, 90, depending on the amount that was owed by the defendant to the casinos or by anybody. If it was under $100,000, it was within 30 days. I see that my time is up. Would you like me to continue? Thank you, Your Honor. So the fact that, you know, the counsel for the state described it as boilerplate language, even if that boilerplate language had some meaning, the casinos, through their course of action and their history in dealing with Mr. Zahavi, routinely disregarded that. He wasn't slowly paying because he was 7 days late. He was slowly paying because he was routinely 90 days, 120 days late. And with that, for those reasons, I think this court should reverse Mr. Zahavi's conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Do any of my colleagues have any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted. And what I would like to do is, again, open the floor to questions from the student body here. Are there questions of the lawyers about this case or about this process?
With the casino's knowledge that gambling consists of a ton of wins and loses, why would they continue to rapidly increase the money value on the markers?
We couldn't hear that. Could you speak more directly into the microphone?
I said, with the casino's knowledge of gambling being a ton of wins and loses, why would they continue to rapidly increase the money value on the markers? For Mr. Zahavi.
Mr. Day, could you restate the question? I think Mr. Zdrowski was waiting to hear it.
I think the question is why, with him having trouble paying or not having the money in the account, why would the casinos continue to lend him money? I think that's a really good question. Your guess is as good as mine. That's really the casinos. I mean, casinos are in the business to make money. I think they hold out the hope that at the end of the day that their gamblers will be able to pay back you know, whatever loans that they've taken out from the casino in terms of casino chips. But it's a situation where my client testified at trial that For example, the Wynn, which is one of the casinos that had, you know, the $700,000 in markers, they had part of that. They told him at one point that they weren't going to lend him any more money and that they weren't going to continue to increase his credit. So they kind of suspended his credit. So some casinos did, some casinos didn't. I think a lot of that goes to how desperate those casinos are for the money.
Mr. Sadowski.
I think it's important for you to understand that I'm a prosecuting attorney for the state. The question of whether or not a business entity, a casino, decides to give credit to somebody given a factual situation that they know previously existed with them is a business decision that's made by the casino. I'm not in a position where I can tell you why or why they don't. That's not my job as an attorney for the state, for the county of Clark. My job is to prosecute cases that are of criminal nature. So the long and the short of it is I can't answer that. That's a question. It's a business decision by the casino that they could answer, but I can't. I'm just not in a position to be able to answer that.
Do we have time for one more question, Mr. Clark?
I was just wondering, when we were reading this case in class, the first trial, he was convicted, and his maximum sentence was 5 years. So if he was convicted and put in jail and it was 5 years, so we passed 5 years, and why is this trial now being brought up? Or was he never put in jail? Does that make sense?
Mr. Sadowski.
This case is not actually... I hope it's not 5 years ago that this case was tried. I think it was 2011. 2011. This case was tried in 2011. But you heard the old statement, the wheels of justice can turn mighty slow. In this case, it does take some time from the time that the marker is passed, which I believe was 2008, to the time where it works through the system of government that we have of first going through the casino in a collection process. They'll spend a lot of time trying to collect on that. Then after the time period that they've attempted to collect, it's only then that they will turn that case over to the district attorney's office for prosecution. So it could be a couple of years. And in fact, in this case, it was a couple of years between the time that the marker was passed to when the district attorney's got it. And then there's some time during the process of gathering evidence for taking the case to trial, so that can take some time. And then, of course, the time from the end of the trial to the time that the case is actually heard by the Supreme Court, that would account for the period of 5 years. But it really has only been a rather short period of time of a couple of years.
Yes, I can add to that. We have the record here on what the dates are. The judgment of conviction was entered on November 8, 2011. That's when he was convicted in the trial court. The notice of appeal was filed thereafter, and then there was a change in lawyers for the appellant, which required us to remand the case, have Mr. Lay appointed, and then the briefing followed. The final brief was filed on December 7th, 2012. So from judgment to argument has been it has been under 2 years. So the act giving rise to the judgment of conviction dates back in the past, but the actual judicial process didn't complete until November 11, 2011 in the trial court.
If I may, just briefly, too, my client was convicted, but he wasn't sentenced to prison. He was sentenced to probation, which is community supervision. And so, you know, he's out free while he's being supervised by parole and probation in Nevada. But he was never sentenced to a jail term or prison.
Thank you very much for that clarification. I also neglected, wait one moment, to introduce to you the clerk of the court, Tracy Lindemann. She keeps track of all of us and all the paperwork in the court, and it is a tall order. So, Tracy, please acknowledge the call.
This is the